For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Welcome, Bodhisattvas. I don't think it is the first time that anyone's been here. Is that correct? It's not. Well, I hope it is your first time. I feel very grateful for the circumstances that are sponsoring our little bit of time together today and this opportunity to sit together. It is your own enlightenment that brings us here today, even if you don't know it. And I've been thinking a lot about what keeps us going in practice and what brings us to this practice, what inspires you to be here today, to practice peace and harmony, to sit on a cushion silently. When I thought about this word inspiration, I looked it up and I was kind of surprised. I thought it meant like, you know, to breathe something in or to be kind of excited about something. And, you know, Brian, you may know this. Do you know the original? What is it? It's a pop quiz.
Spirit, take in spirit.
Take in spirit. I also read, you know, who knows how accurate Google is, but that it is the divine influence that allows a person to receive and communicate sacred revelation. So I thought, wow, it's pretty good. So what is this inspiration in practice that brings us here, that somehow sparked your practice, that provides the energy to come here when it might be easier to lay in bed, have a nice cup of coffee? On that note, at least I get a little cool water. Sorry you don't have one. Sometimes this is called way-seeking mind, notion. Sometimes it is called beginner's mind. I think that's Shoshin. That word for mind is the second character from the top on that piece of calligraphy, which is a heart. So what is it in your heart that inspires you to practice this radically inclusive practice, this vow to awaken with the entire earth and all the beings? Sometimes this wish to practice for the benefit of all beings is referred to as bodhicitta. It's a very famous and kind of beautiful concept, maybe. Something made up, but I kind of like it. So bodhicitta, which many of you have probably heard of, it comes from this term bodhi, which is awakening, or you could say Buddha. And citta, which is mind. So that word, that shin, that second character, is actually the Japanese kind of interpretation of this Sanskrit word citta, which sometimes is attitude, spirit, heart, mind. The mind that turn towards awakening, you could say, is bodhicitta. The spirit. This is a precious mystery and a revelation that's personal to each of you. You know, it's good to study the causes and conditions of where this deep wish to kind of joyous wish to turn away from self-centeredness towards harmony and care for the world. And it's really like a reversal of our normal mode of working in the world. So I wouldn't underestimate that. You know, one way in which this bodhicitta has been described is a flash of lightning in the dark sky. But this flash is, the dark sky is the dark sky of the way our minds are usually working. At least the way my mind works. I don't know if you notice this in Zazen. Like when I started sitting Zazen, I thought, I thought I was a nice person until I sat down and watched what was going on in my mind. Let me get this, you know, kind of like Gollum. Mine, the ring, you know, precious. You saw what happened to Gollum, right? So intoxicated by wanting to secure something, wanting to control, wanting to hide, wanting to be perfect or beautiful, whatever that intoxication is. This is the normal order of business. I think we can see this operating in various sectors of our external world. And it doesn't seem that that project works very well, but it does seem to still continue, you know. At any cost. Let's just like crack a hole in the earth and pump some chemicals into it and extract some gas and sell it and not care how that impacts the rest of the world. It's just one small example. But it might be like, let me get to that stoplight first before the person next to me driving. Or I want that cookie. You know, so after we have tea and cookies, you know, so you'll pick out your favorite cookie and try to like angle your way towards it. Hoping nobody sees, because, you know, we're not supposed to practice greed, hatred, and delusion. So this bodhicitta business is not just the initial thought of, oh, maybe it's a good idea to sit down in a cushion and reverse this problem. Or maybe like, maybe I'll sit down on this cushion so I can get rid of all my problems and all the problems of the world. And then I won't have to feel any difficulty or pain. Nobody can hurt me then. So you see how this self-centeredness is operating. And don't feel bad about that. I mean, maybe let's say, don't get too self-involved with your own self-involvement. It's just normal human condition, bodhisattvas. But this bodhicitta is kind of a revolutionary reversal of that flow of our kind of biology. Kind of move to say something from the founder of our school in praise of this Zazen situation, in praise of this desire for awakening for the benefit of all beings. So the founder of our school in medieval Japan was maybe like 42 when this was written, said something, you know, in like 1242, just a long time ago. It's kind of amazing. Like, people have been doing this practice, what, since Buddha's time at least, and still there are problems in the world. The aspiration for enlightenment is aroused by the aspiration for enlightenment. So you're not doing it. It's kind of arising, doing you. To arouse the aspiration for enlightenment is to pick up a blade of grass and manifest a Buddha image. To take up a rootless tree and create a sutra, which are the words of Buddha. To arouse the aspiration for enlightenment is to make an offering of sand or rice water to the Buddha. It is to make an offering of a handful of food to sentient beings. It is to make an offering of a bouquet of flowers to the Buddha, or to bow to the Buddha following a demon's deceptive advice. So I might be that demon giving you some deceptive advice, so watch out. But still, to practice a small virtuous act with the encouragement of someone else, or to bow to the Buddha following a demon's deceptive advice, is also bodhicitta. So I think that this is an interesting thing. So we sometimes forget about this inspiration to practice. But actually, we have reminders of it all over the place, here and everywhere in our life, as a practice of offering and receiving. Even if it's receiving something from some kind of, what was that kind of demon? Just a regular demon, but the advice was deceptive. So, I don't know, does that mean like fake news is somehow inspiring us? I'm not sure. So sometimes this concept of bodhicitta is associated with Tibetan teaching. It's pretty common and revered in that teaching. And I hadn't really thought it was kind of old school back to Buddha's time. But then Dogen, sly old dog that he is. So Dogen was like a virtuoso of the Buddhist canon. You know, apparently he was like a child and had read everything ever written and had a great memory for it. So in this writing, he references that Mahakashyapa, who was the first disciple Buddha made a transmission of his mind to directly heart-mind, extolled Shakyamuni Buddha with a verse. Although beginner's mind and ultimate mind are indistinguishable, the beginner's mind is more difficult. I bow to the beginner's mind that lets others awaken first. So this is a mind that is moving away from control and self-involvement to compassion and love. Apparently, popular since the beginning. So I would encourage all of you to study what awakens and supports your bodhicitta. What are the obstacles or stumbling blocks or roadblocks that get us distracted from this innermost request? And then also to study what maintains this way-seeking heart and reconnects. Because I don't know about you, but I sometimes get distracted and forget. And I want to put myself first, and I think I'm a separate person, and I want to elbow everybody out of the way. And just like in our kinhin, we're creating this harmonious situation where we're moving as one. And in some ways, this is just a little improv or expression, you know, that we play with of what's actually happening all the time, but we don't see it and we forget it. And the universe will give us some signs that we forgot it, like something like climate change. Or the pain you feel if you see children removed from their parents at the border, or other things that arise that we feel like something's painful, often that's a clue that somebody's forgotten about this ultimate concern, this moving away from self-centeredness. And that reminds us, so that can help us awaken. And it's a happy awakening, even in the midst of the pain of the world. What is our time situation? And when should we cease this event, approximately? 11? Okay. So much that we could talk about. But maybe I'll just invite you right now just to close your eyes for a minute. And settle into your body and your breath and your mind. And explore what brought you here today. What is your innermost request? Can you actually find that bodhicitta, that little spark? Maybe you can't. Just note what arises in your consciousness. Whatever arises is your own enlightenment, bodhisattvas, even if you don't think it is. So just, you know, allow whatever that is to be what it is in your body and in your mind. Then let's just open our eyes and think about this a little. Like I said, virtuous thought sometimes is this somewhat rare occurrence in our mind streams. Maybe you're like, ah, I've got this nice virtuous thought. Whew. I'm full of bodhicitta. But I heard that Suzuki Roshi encouraged his students not to be self-centered, and didn't do that in a shaming way, but in a clear way, acknowledging that human consciousness has this quality of self-centeredness, I would say, wired into it. Mm-hmm. This kind of self-involvement. And I tend to think of this as a survival mechanism. You know, we were born or hatched with some kind of biology that's focused on a limited view of survival. And This is maybe why we practice. You know, we need to survive, so we need an ego. It's not going to go away anywhere. I always like to say the ego's our little pet. We have to take care of it. But there's a way that we start to realize that no matter how much we try, you know, the world's going to disappoint us. Not everything's going to be the way we want it to be. And that's really the root of suffering, that idea that my personal little nest of happiness is the only thing that matters. And that's a very limited, constrained view of the self. It's very uncomfortable and tight. And this bodhicitta is like, oh, as Dogen has also said, the entire universe is a true human body. So how do we live with that body? How do we know it and express it, that truth? So I feel like we have to kind of rewire our biology. So sitting sometimes helps us not act out the habit patterns, and then slowly saturate us with this opening of bodhicitta and expanding ourselves to include everything. So it's kind of a radical inclusivity. But if you don't feel that, or that you haven't gotten there yet, I think you're in good company. So we can just help each other and support each other in that kind of practice, and study when we're sitting still. And what can happen is that flash of light against this dark gloom of delusion eventually moves from the background to the foreground. So then, you know, I think sometimes when you sit for a while, or for, let's say, after maybe 10 or 20 years, you notice, like, the lightning shock is the deluded thoughts. They're like, really, like, you get electrocuted by them. And, you know, so you have this background of big mind, you could say, or this expansiveness, and then you see this, you know, the habits arise that are full of narcissism, and they're uncomfortable. But you relax with them. You know, the sky isn't disturbed. The blue sky can accommodate the dark clouds of delusion. So I guess I just encourage you to study the workings of all this stuff, even though you're not supposed to do anything in Zazen. When you various things appear and disappear within your awareness, it might be good to kind of be on the lookout for bodhicitta, or the stumbling blocks. And then those stumbling blocks gets transformed into the energy for more bodhicitta. It's like compost. You know, you compost your delusion, your self-centeredness. There are so many, many practices that maintain and connect us to our deepest desire and give us the courage to move forward in that, from this self-centeredness that then breaks down and opens up into that kind of lotus flower we have in Buddhism. And you have to find the ones that are supportive of you at different times in your practice. Like, for instance, today, I noted that one thing that's made things a little difficult lately is I've had a problem with my sciatic nerve, so I've had to, like, figure out how to arrange my cushions to be kind to that nerve. And it takes a little while for me to get settled to do that. I think sometimes when we sit, you know, we begin with a kind of violence against ourselves, of, like, forcing yourself into some position. And, you know, I should sit in a certain way, you know. And I think part of that opening is finding what works for yourself in a given time. So this bodhicitta starts with ourselves, this softening and paying attention instead of having a closed idea of this is what it means to be a Zen person. You know, I sit like in full lotus for never move, and I'm super, you know, and our bodies are all different and they change over time. So you even just start with yourself, and once you do that, and once you get really relaxed and comfortable, that energy flows. But at any point in time, we can forget all this, and problems happen. And also, at any point in time, some imperceptible assistance, mutual assistance, is available at all times. So we can draw on that from each other, from the universe. There's another thing, another little quote I will share with you about this wondrous desire to realize our wholeness and heal our world, from a great text that I suggest chanting, called the Avatamsaka Sutra, which is designed to arouse and sustain and broaden and develop this mind. It's called the Flower Ornament Sutra, but here's a little snippet from that. It says, upon first arousing the aspiration in the midst of your lives, their lives, the bodhisattva wholeheartedly seeks enlightenment, in parentheses, living for the welfare of the entire universe, without exception, firmly and immovably, that is, without distraction. That's what's sought. The merit of this single intention is so deep, broad, and boundless that were all the Buddhas to explain its particulars, they could not exhaust them by the end of the universe. That is pretty good thing to strive for. So this is something that I feel like, you know, maybe I will say this, it might sound a little extra, but I will say this, that is my intention, is to completely realize that 24/7. And not to get distracted by the fact that sometimes I can't do that and get too hung up on like, oh my God, I'm not really a good enough Buddhist practitioner. Already that's falling into some kind of negative self-clinging. But more like, oh, this is the way the whole universe is working itself out, and I'm very grateful, hopefully, for the difficulties in this world. And there is so much difficulty, bodhisattvas, in our world. There are a lot of petty acts rooted in anger, greed, and fear. And these are manifested currently and probably in the past and future, at least the future that I'll be alive for in this human body, that manifest as things like injustice, racism, sexism, and harm to the earth and to life. But I feel sure that we can meet these situations if we ground ourselves in our deepest heart and intention, and that healing will occur. And this is how I believe we heal the world together. That's my wish. And thank you for supporting me in exploring that and living in this world of endurance. So, on that note, maybe there's some time for us to comment on your own experience of such a situation or any questions. So share your bodhicitta, bodhisattvas. Yes?
So I recall that I read Suzuki Roshi's book, Sense My Beginner's Mind, and it had been really confusing to me why he says, like, just the act of sitting is an embodiment of enlightenment. Oftentimes when I sit, I can sometimes feel like, oh wow, this is such a wonderful thought, and or like, oh, this thought is like, I probably really got some wisdom out of the sitting. And like, and just now I actually had this sort of experience, like, wow, this is like real, I just got so, like, it feels like, wow, I'm getting a little better of some sort. And, but actually, just as you talk, I feel like it's really, I feel like It's not anything like really special or about any thought, but really just the act of sitting like in very plain or ordinary way is sort of what it's supposed to be. I'm probably not making sense.
Yeah. I mean, Dogen in here also says bodhicitta is zazen. But you noticed it sounds like that there was this tendency to be like, oh, this is a good one.
Yeah.
I like this one. I don't want that other one. But this is the kind of imperceptible situation. So it's okay to have that thought and confess. And then like you have that thought and you let it go and then you just settle a little more. And it's, yeah, nothing special. But totally radical. A little radical event here. Thank you. Aspiration, I mean, is sort of wanting to achieve something, right? That's why I like inspiration a little better, even though bodhicitta does have this aspiration. But I think when you're talking about trying to build a best self, I mean, I have no problem with taking care of one's body. But if dedicate that to the welfare of all beings. So somehow I kind of feel like, you know, self-improvement, again, is it taking care of the self? Or is it actually killing you and other beings? So, I mean, I think this is a very good point. But again, like, there's this thing in the culture, I'll live forever. I've never met anybody who's not going to die. And in some cultures, it seems people smoke and drink and they have a larger, longer life expectancy than the U.S. Like, I think I want to move there, you know? So, you know, the self-improvement is trying to ward off. So fear is what's underneath. If fear is underneath it, like, oh, I'm scared of dying, so like I'm going to try to make a perfect body. What is that song? Like, isn't it Creep? I want a perfect body. I want a perfect mind. Like, there's some creepy about that, you know? It's like perfect is like there's some end game, you know? And then what are you, plastic self? Do you never change? So the world's constantly changing. So when you're in the flow of that, there's a joy to it. There's not an anxiety and a crushing feeling. So if you're working out or making your delicious nutritional beverage, and there's a joy in that and it's a dedication, I think that's okay. But I'd look at that fear that drives so much. And, you know, part of a bodhisattva's quality that cultivated is fearlessness. So, you know, a fearlessness to, like, take on life, knowing that it's death is around the corner, you know. But there's that improvement, like, I have to be better in order to be loved. You know. So ridiculous. It's like, you know, we love each other. Just love each other. Just love the world. It'll be fine. So thank you for that. Yeah, so.
Discovering the self rather than building the self. Each being is simultaneously, the thusness of true reality and a distinct manifestation of it. Mm-hmm. So our job in our lives could be to really discover what that self really is. And so I think for each of us there's different, we're kind of attuned to different practices that kind of help us discover what that self is. So it could be, and I think that's kind of the challenge of your life, is to figure out what those things are. Are you a woodworker? Are you a writer? Are you a marathon runner? Are you a kung fu instructor? Are you a Zen teacher? Are you all of those different things, and then dedicating your energy to it. You find those activities that are both feeding you and you're feeding it at the same time. There's a little bit of challenge in it. You're kind of setting up. You're challenging yourself, but there's an aspect of offering in it as well. As you were saying, when you really dedicate your energy to that, on a daily basis, of finding what those practices are, and then the determination to cultivate them and honor what you are uniquely capable of giving to the world. I think that's the pivot. That's essential. Rather than I'm not perfect and I have to build the perfect self, it's I'm uniquely able to do something, or maybe a couple of things. What are those things? And find them and honor them and give them.
For you.
Maybe.
And there is that sense of devoting one's life energy. Suzuki Roshi talks about burning yourself up completely in your activity. However, there may be some people, like Bodhidharma, whose odd-looking statue is sitting on the altar up there. This is the founder of our school. People are who are you? I don't know. Some people, they never go, I'm devoting myself to this thing. They're just okay, in this moment, this is happening, and I don't know what it is the next month. I don't even know who I am. Who is the self? I don't know. That's also a possibility. So I just think, there's not one way that it manifests, that we just create, openings for that. And that's what you're talking about, just being open to that. And then, if you're a woodworker or a kung fu instructor or a space cadet, it's all okay. Jason.
I feel, to piggyback on Dylan and then circle back to Brian, the difference maybe in some ways between the Instagram selfie, live your best life culture, and aspiration, which in some ways do look very similar, is an aspiration.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that this impact is this impact, I think that changes this. I'll have that wheat grass juice. It's not so tasty, but so I'm okay with that. But that there is a flexibility there of knowing that if I don't have wheat grass juice, mm-hmm. I gain 5 extra pounds. I'm worth it still.
That the universe is helping you with that situation at all times, and you're helping it, even if it doesn't feel that way. And there is that sense of vow. I think about, what is your vow? When you get in the car, when you wake up in the morning with your spouse or partner, or animal companion. There's a sense that we're manifesting a certain kind of unconscious vow all the time. And in practice, there's a kind of vow that we root very deeply that becomes unconscious almost, this deep wish, because we see the larger self, right? It's not stuck, it's a larger, that's what you're talking about. This vow is the large vow with all beings from this life onwards. So wheatgrass can be tasty. David.
Something Jason said kind of sparked me. I think part of it is that, you know, in our lives, we just feel so empty, so that the Instagram, the tweet, and the, you know, constant look, you know, is to make up for that emptiness. I'm having a kind of an opposite, in a sense, that I'm finding there are moments when I'm feeling really connected and really in the world, and then I start grasping for that feeling. You know, when I don't have that, it happens to me because of what I do, that it happens often, and, or I have the opportunity to have that. And so when I'm not doing those activities which induce and inspire that connection, okay, later on I'm saying, how can I get that again? And that becomes my clinging. And that's something I have to be aware of, maybe careful of. So, you know, that's another road that leaves you separate. It's all about yourself.
Yeah, so then you feel the separateness. Just when I thought I was feeling so good, I start like, ugh, that doesn't... I just realized I'm grasping, and then you let go, and you're still doing the same thing, being helpful to people, but it's different. So there's... So you feel it, and it's very embodied in practice. And you learn that. So thank you for that confession.